First Congress. The First Congress was a milestone in American constitutional development, and people don't usually think of the Constitution as being beyond the Philadelphia Convention, the Ratification Conventions, and later court decisions for the most part. But when George Washington took his hand off the Bible on Wall Street, having been inaugurated as the first president of the United States, he had set several quasi-constitutional precedents. First of all, he had taken the oath of office in public, and this was something that virtually all presidents were going to do thereafter. He had taken it with the Congress in attendance, and again, the Constitution didn't require that that be done, but the example of the father of his country was going to be a powerful influence on decisions of later presidents about the way that their inaugurations would be conducted. The fact that he had his hand on a Bible was going to shape very powerful constitutional expectation too, and all the way down to 2013 there have been only a very few presidents who have not put their hands on Bible. There actually is some discussion among historians of the question exactly what Washington said in taking the oath of office. It has been very common for people to assert that Washington ended the constitutional oath with the addition of the phrase, "So help me God." But there's now some bit of argument about the issue, whether he did say, "So help me God." And it seems generally that because there's been so powerful a tradition saying that he did, that we ought to accept it. But in recent years, an argument has been made that really we don't have very good proof of that, and so should be skeptics about it. Washington thought, and this is something else that the Constitution doesn't require, that he ought to say a few words once he had completed the constitutional oath of office. And so he turned to James Madison, who in those days was serving as a kind of prime minister, for advice about what to say. Madison then drafted him a farewell address. If it's true, as has been said, that brevity is the soul of wit, well, Madison and Washington outwitted virtually all of their successors. So Washington's address took only a very few minutes, and then he turned and accepted the applause of the people on Wall Street. What he did essentially was to lay out his expectations of his administration, mostly by denying that he was up to the job and saying that he hoped that other people in high federal offices would help him in it. In the first 5 years of its existence, the Senate met in private, in secret. This was consistent with the way the British government behaved, with precedents from before American republicanism, but of course, as we know, eventually would be an example that was rejected by American statesmen who have come to think that publicity before all is a very important consideration. The House, for its part, met in public, and reporters were present from the very beginning, so we do have some fragmentary, sketchy, kind of hit-and-miss record of what was said in the earliest days of the House of Representatives. Congress had very important work to do when they had been sworn in. So the way this worked was that the ninth state, the one activating the Constitution, ratified the Constitution in June of 1788. Then there were going to be elections both for the House of Representatives, popular, and for the Senate by the state legislatures. And, of course, an electoral college was going to choose both the first vice president and the first president. But when Washington took his hand off that Bible, there was exactly one person in the executive branch. And so the Congress had hurriedly to get about the business of setting up the first cabinet departments. There were originally three departments of the federal government, in order of their creation, state, treasury, and war. At the State Department, it seemed obvious to James Madison, who again gave Washington extensive advice in personnel matters, not only in regard to the executive branch, but also when it came to staffing the judiciary, that Thomas Jefferson, who long had been America's minister to France, ought to be the first Secretary of State, because John Jay had responded to Washington's query which office Jay would prefer by saying to Washington, surprised that he'd like to be the first Chief Justice. The office was available to Jefferson, and Jefferson's name was put in nomination, and he was confirmed by the Senate without his even knowing this was going on. He was actually in a ship across the on his way back across the Atlantic to arrive here, only to be told that he was Secretary of State. And then he had to consider the question, well, do I want this job? Apparently, Jefferson had intended to go back to France, which was a place and a post that he quite liked. But ultimately, like virtually everybody else in the American political elite, Jefferson decided that he owed Washington his compliance with the president's request, and so took on the job of Secretary of State. This job was more than what it is today. Today, of course, the American Secretary of State is what amounts to a foreign minister. That's what she'd be called, or he'd be called, in European government or a government elsewhere in the world. But at the beginning, it wasn't only diplomatic questions that the Secretary of State was going to be concerned with. He had other jobs too, such as keeping the federal government's records, handling registration of patents, ultimately copyrights and trademarks. These were all going to be things that the Secretary of State dealt with, and keeping an eye on weights and measures, which was a power that Congress was given expressly by Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, and which they lodged in the State Department. The second of the three original departments was the Treasury Department. Here, Madison gave Washington suggestions, and a couple of people turned the position down before finally they lit, that is, Madison and Washington lit on Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton was very well known to Madison from their cooperation in writing the Federalist, from their both having been active in the Philadelphia Convention, both having attended the Annapolis Convention, having been in Congress together. And Madison, like others, was impressed with Hamilton. Hamilton actually, when he was in his very earliest 20s, had spent his downtime as a colonel on General Washington's staff in the Continental Army, writing out plans for a national bank and other European mercantilist type measures that the United States government ought to create or take. And so Hamilton certainly was ready for the task, insofar as a mercantilist would be ready for this task. The third of the original cabinet offices was that of War Secretary, and here Henry Knox, who had been the head of Washington's artillery during the war and had been in the same position under the Confederation Congress, stayed on. Besides the fact that they were talking about creating the cabinet offices and creating the first federal departments, another issue that the first Congress busied itself with was creation of a judicial branch. The Constitution in Article 3 said that there would be a Supreme Court, and such inferior courts as Congress from time to time might ordain and establish. And there had been a lot of debate, a lot of contention during the ratification process over the question whether there needed to be inferior federal courts or the state courts could be trusted with this job. So vociferous were the people who insisted that there was no reason to have a separate state judiciary that at one point, during the ratification dispute, James Madison vowed that, well, we'll try having a federal government without a federal judiciary, but the first Congress, that is, without having inferior courts in the federal judiciary, but the first Congress essentially went back on Madison's promise, if Madison ever pointed it out to them. Actually, that's not clear. But two significant senators who had both been members of the Philadelphia Convention and then played important roles in securing ratification in their states, Ellsworth of Connecticut and Patterson of New Jersey, jointly authored the Judiciary Act of 1789. When polled on the question in 1939 for the federal government's sesquicentennial, what was the most important law ever adopted by Congress, a clear consensus among American political scientists and historians besides legal scholars, was that the most important such law was the Judiciary Act of 1789. What the Judiciary Act of 1789 did was to create the structure of a federal court system that we still have in 2013. There were several elements of it that remain in effect today. One is, of course, that there would be a Supreme Court. Originally, there were six justices, including the Chief Justice. There also was to be at least one federal district court, that is, one federal trial court in each state, and depending on the population and the geographic extent of a state, it might have more than one district court, but each state was to have at least one federal district court, that is, one federal trial court. And between the district courts and the Supreme Court, there was to be an intermediate level of federal courts, what were called circuit courts of appeals, so that each state would have its at least one district court, and then each state's district would be within a circuit, of which there were originally six. That's why there were originally six justices on the Supreme Court. The idea was that in the early days, the Supreme Court, as chiefly an appellate court, wouldn't have much business. There hadn't been any federal trials. There wouldn't be anything being appealed. There wouldn't have much to do. And so anybody who was a justice on the Supreme Court would serve also as a judge of this intermediate level court, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. Each justice was assigned one circuit court on which he would be the circuit justice, and his job was to travel among the federal district courts in his circuit and serve jointly with the local district judge or judges as the local circuit court of appeals. You can see that this system could be extended as the United States grew enormously in territorial extent. That is, it didn't matter how many states you have, each one of them could have at least one federal district court. Each state, as its population grew, could have additional federal district courts, or a particular federal district could have additional judges, so that, for example, Texas has four federal districts, and each of those districts has numerous federal district court judges. And then, as the country grew, well, there could be more federal circuits than there had been before, and so now the number is in the mid-teens. But the pyramidal structure of the federal court system would remain in place. The number nine for the number of justices on the Supreme Court was hit upon in the middle of the 19th century and has proved more or less sacrosanct since then. Another feature of the Judiciary Act of 1789 had to do with the law that would be applied in federal courts when there were suits over which federal courts had jurisdiction because of diversity of citizenship. The Article III enumeration of types of cases over which Congress was going to be empowered to give federal courts jurisdiction included cases in which there was diversity of citizenship, that is, cases in which the parties were from different states. So if a New Jerseyan traveling in Alabama is injured in some way by an Alabamian, he can, if his claim is for $50,000 or more, sue in federal district court in Alabama. He doesn't have to go into the state court. The idea is that the idea behind diversity of citizenship jurisdiction was that a local court with elected judges might tend to favor, or likely would tend to favor, its own citizenry over those citizens from other states. But on the other hand, these federal district court judges were going to be appointed, not elected, so it would be free to be fair to interlopers from other states. But the question that arose, of course, was, well, if we had a suit like that, which law would apply? Would it be the Alabama law? Would it be the law of the traveling plaintiff? Would it be some federal law that was neither Alabamian nor the law of the person who was traveling in Alabama? And, of course, it's all somewhat anachronistic since there wasn't yet no Alabamian, no Alabama, but the point is, this question arose, and the Congress decided in the Judiciary Act of 1789 that whenever there was a diversity of citizenship case in a federal court, the law of the forum state would apply. So the idea was that if I set out from Connecticut and traveled to Wisconsin, I would take it upon myself to be subject to the law of Wisconsin. I would be consenting to that as I traveled to Wisconsin, and it made sense then that the local district court judge, who was going to be familiar with Wisconsin law, should be applying his law too. Another issue that was decided by the Judiciary Act of 1789 had to do with appellability of decisions of state Supreme Courts to the U.S. Supreme Court. And what the Congress decided was that, yes, if there was a federal question in a state lawsuit, this would be appellable. The decision of the state court would be appellable to the U.S. Supreme Court. Notice, not everything that was decided in this suit would be appellable to the U.S. Supreme Court. The only thing that would be the way that the state court decided the federal issue. So you might have a lawsuit between two people over a breach of contract, and there might be somewhere in there a claim about, sex discrimination, race discrimination, some other federal question, and the outcome of the lawsuit might be affected by the court's decision of that federal issue. And so if a party were aggrieved by the outcome in his state Supreme Court and wanted to, he could appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. You might think, well, that makes sense. It seems self-evident that this was going to be possible. But again, there was a lot of dispute over that question, and ultimately it would be controverted by the Virginia Court of Appeals in a famous 1816 case. While these issues of the creation of the federal executive branch and the federal judiciary proceeded, James Madison in particular brought up in the House of Representatives over and over again the question of a Bill of Rights. So, Madison had been one of those who said in the Philadelphia Convention that a Bill of Rights was not necessary because the U.S. government's powers were going to be only those enumerated, and there was no enumerated power to tranche on people's right to bear arms or right not to have their house searched without a warrant or right to a speedy trial or anything like that. So, but as we've seen in an earlier lecture, the anti-federalists made great hay in numerous states over the fact that there was no Bill of Rights in the U.S. Constitution. What are we to make of the omission of a Bill of Rights, they said? Why would these people writing a new constitution leave out recognition of the fact that we have these inherited historic rights that were rights of Englishmen and now are rights of Americans? And so Madison ultimately promised, as part of his campaign for membership in the first U.S. House of Representatives, that when he got to the House of Representatives, he would push for amendments. There were several things to notice about these amendments. One is that Madison made clear to people in the House of Representatives, as he'd made clear in correspondence before this, that he did not intend for these amendments to go to the actual powers of the government. So where people like George Mason had been anti-federalists partly because they thought that Congress was being given too broad discretion in taxing, or where they thought that there should be a two-thirds vote necessary to levy a tariff, or whether they were concerned with the relationship between the President and the Senate, or the exclusion of the House of Representatives in making treaties, or whatever issue, Madison did not want any of these amendments to undercut the powers that were being granted to the new U.S. government, as essentially all of the ones I just named, all of the ideas I just named would have done. So he made clear he was going to exclude any such changes from his list of amendments. On the other hand, he explained to his fellow members of the House of Representatives, he had come to be persuaded that having a Bill of Rights probably couldn't hurt anything, and it could have the positive effect of reassuring some people who would otherwise have been well disposed but who were leery of this new government because it didn't include a Bill of Rights. So ultimately what happened was that other people in the House of Representatives, tired of Madison saying these things, tired of him hitting on this issue of Bill of Rights. In fact, one rather sardonic congressman from Massachusetts noted in his private correspondence that it seemed that Madison was entirely concerned with his domestic political standing back in Virginia. Madison had reason to be, since Virginia's legislature had excluded him from the first Senate over its fears of this new federal government. Anyway, Madison finally got the House of Representatives to approve a suite of proposed changes, which then were sent to a conference committee and worked out with the Senate. Ultimately, the Congress sent 12 proposed amendments out to the states, and as we know, in 1791, 10 of them were ratified. These became known to history as the Bill of Rights, although before the 10 were ratified, people were calling the 12 proposed amendments the Bill of Rights. Anyway, one of those other two was finally ratified in 1992. So we have the peculiar situation of James Madison, who died in 1836, having written an amendment to the Constitution that was ratified in 1992, 156 years later. Actually, a very odd kind of a development, but it underscores the fact that the actors in creating the U.S. Constitution were not the individual American citizens, but the states as sovereign bodies of citizens. And a state, unlike, that is, a state understood as a sovereign body of citizens, is unlike an individual in being immortal. Now, that when that 1992 ratification finally made the 27th Amendment part of the Constitution, there was a lot of talk over the question, well, doesn't this require a contemporaneous agreement of the American people? But finally, Congress and the Secretary of State made the correct decision that no, it didn't. And what it required eventually were three quarters of the states to ratify, and that's what happened in 1992. The last of them finally did ratify. Madison had different ideas for what these amendments should look like than a lot of other people did. He proposed, for example, sprinkling the changes that he was proposing through the Constitution. So, for example, amendments like the 7th Amendment that had to do with trials ought to be included in Article 3, or amendments like the 1st Amendment that had to do with the powers of Congress ought to be included in Article 1, and so on. And Roger Sherman from Connecticut, who had like Madison, been a member of the Philadelphia Convention, and like Madison, there opposed the idea of a Bill of Rights, objected to this idea of sprinkling amendments through the Constitution. As Sherman explained it, the amendments and the main body of the Constitution were of two different natures. The main body of the Constitution was the voice of the people speaking directly, and this proposed suite of amendments was going to be adopted by the Congress as proposals and then agreed to by state governments. It should not be seen as of the same level of significance. So certainly we didn't want to undercut the respect that people had for the main body of the Constitution by altering the document that had been signed by George Washington, Ben Franklin, and so on. Ultimately, although Madison pushed the point, he thought it made more sense to have the provisions of his proposed amendments included where they logically ought to have been if they had been in the first original unamended Constitution. The Congress rejected this idea, and so it was the House of Representatives that decided that we would have a main Constitution and then amendments tacked on to the end so that we can now refer to the 4th Amendment or the 9th Amendment or the 16th Amendment or 17th, if we want to refer to that, or in any other instance, refer to amendments by number instead of talking about just some language in Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, and so on. Madison also proposed, there was one instance in which he actually proposed, and this is a typical Madisonian feint here, he proposed an amendment that would have further empowered the federal government. What he wanted to do was to have an amendment that said that the trial by jury, that religious freedom, and that press freedom had to be respected by the states. This was the one significant proposal that Madison made in the House of Representatives in this whole contest for amending or whole effort to amend the Constitution. That was rejected. The people in the Congress did not like the idea of using the Bill of Rights further to empower the states, and so that did not happen. Madison later said he thought this was, or at the time he actually said he thought this was the most important of his proposals. People who had been firm proponents of a Bill of Rights, like, for example, Virginia's first two U.S. senators, William Grayson and Richard Henry Lee, were very unhappy with the 12 proposed amendments that were ultimately sent by the Congress to the states. And Patrick Henry, their collaborator in trying to wring amendments from Madison and his colleagues, said that Virginia had been tricked, which perhaps it had been. That is, likely people in Virginia's ratification convention hoped for a little more than this. And one historian referred to James Madison's work in securing 12 proposals to be sent to the states for the ratification as, quote, a tub to the whale. This is an image from an 18th century short story. The metaphor is of whaling ships. And apparently, there were some kinds of whales that would actually attack wooden ships. They could sink a ship. And so often what the sailors would do is they would carry large shiny things like metal tubs on their ships and use them to throw overboard to distract a whale in case they thought the ship was endangered. This was what the strongest proponents of amendment of the Constitution thought of Madison's suite of amendments, that they weren't really very significant. And in fact, Madison, as I explained a few minutes ago, intended them not to have very much effect. They, with the notable exception of Dred Scott versus Sanford, didn't form the basis of any significant legal decision until the 20th century. So Madison got what he wanted. Some people who had been otherwise well disposed in regard to the new government became better disposed after they saw the amendments, and it didn't undercut the power of the central government at all.